We are going to be in conversation with Nads Al-Busaidi. He's the first Arab to accomplish some huge travel feats. He was voted one of the top 100 most influential Arabs in the world by Arabian Business Magazine. And he has travelled to over 85 countries, so he knows his stuff, Michelle.
85, you say?
85 countries. Wow. I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, how many have I been to? Probably 22 or something.
That still sounds like
a push.
Lot. Yeah, I don't think I've even been to that many.
We should write a list and add them up. Maybe I'm over-exaggerating. I have been known to do that. You're going to hear about some of his adventures this afternoon, as well as hear his tracks of my travels. Make sure your radio's on after 1:30 today. But what is it that makes him want to do this in the first place?
Well, it's on a deeper level. That's just humanity, right? Humanity has a need to explore the boundaries of their knowledge, of their experience, and expand it.
But not everyone, I don't feel like everyone feels the need to do it to risk their safety necessarily.
Yeah, but you know, with every human endeavor, somebody has to be first, right? Mm. And the first person that ever does anything is always the crazy one. But so the first person that ever parachuted would have been considered crazy, right? The first person that ever flew a plane, everyone, you know, considers them crackpots. But now it's quite a normal thing, right?
But I'm not sure rowing across the Atlantic Ocean is ever going to be a normal thing.
Okay, you had to pick the one example that, yeah. No, actually, so a lot of the things that I've done are probably never going to be mainstream, right? But the first person to walk to the North Pole was in 1908, and still only about 400 people have ever done it in the last 100 years. So, yeah, you're right. It's not going to be a mainstream activity.
So what is it inside you that makes you do that, or want to do that? Because I definitely do not have it, and I'm pretty sure I'm human.
Okay, but I'm sure you have your own area of expertise where you, for example, you're on the radio, right? I mean, maybe I couldn't do that. Maybe you've pushed your expertise and your ability in this particular area. Mine just happened to be going to the North Pole, right?
So he just thinks that it's in you. You need to see more and explore further. Do you ever see yourself climbing a mountain, Michelle?
Ooh, I don't think I'd be very good at that.
No?
I really admire the people that go up Kilimanjaro or, you know, summit K2. But I don't think I'd be
You're not one of them.
No.
Very few amongst us are. Now, you know, when you think back to your last holiday, yours was France in December.
Yes.
What image, the one image that immediately comes to mind, what is it?
The snowy mountains. The snowy mountains in a little town called La Clusaz, because I had never seen snow before. So
that's so exciting.
I just loved it. It was just like the movies.
Oh my gosh. Well, I asked Nads which image comes to mind when he remembers his North Pole trip.
The sort of defining image of that is there was a picture taken of me at the North Pole. When we were going there, there were five teams separately, but at the same time going towards the magnetic North Pole. We were all about 50 kilometers away from the North Pole, all five teams, roughly around the same distance. And me and my two other teammates, we just decided, you know, we want to be the first. We want to be the first to get there. And we were walking about 30 kilometers a day. So we knew that if we walked 30 kilometers the next day and camped overnight, like all the other teams, there would be 20 kilometers left on the next day. And it would be basically a race between all the five teams to try and get there first. And, you know, it's a gamble who's going to come first in a foot race. So we just said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to walk the 30 kilometers like everyone else, and everyone else is going to put up their tents and go to sleep for the night. We're not going to put our tents up. We're going to actually go do our safety call back to Resolute Bay, tell them where we're supposed to be camping for the night, and then we're going to carry on walking throughout the night. You got to remember, at that time in the North Pole, there's no sun, there's no nighttime. It's 24-hour sunlight. So there was no night time to go to sleep. So we just said, you know what, we'll just walk. We can see. So why don't we just walk while everyone else is sleeping? And we'll be able to do that 20 kilometers before everyone has got up to walk the next day. We'll already arrived at the North Pole.
Michelle, does that sound like an idea? Had you been on the team that you would have gone for?
This guy. No.
It's not a race.
Like, he, I, I, tough. You know, he's very inspiring, but part of me is like, dude, I want to lie down.
It's competitive, right?
It's very competitive. We will walk all night. We're like, yay, best team ever.
Are you interested to know how that went for them?
Did they burn out?
Take a listen.
Anyway, having already walked about 700 kilometers, this extra push, you know, it drove us over the edge. We were hallucinating. We walked through blizzards. It was the craziest, craziest 24 hours. I lost 10 kilos. And when we got to the end, my teammate took a photograph of me. And, you know, I put my hands up in the air and I was like, thank you. Well, actually, that's not exactly what I said, but we got to the North Pole. And I was, you know, we were celebrating. There's this photograph of me at the North Pole with my hands in the air, sort of screaming in delight. And that is, whenever anyone talks about the North Pole, that's the sort of image that's in my head of me at being at the North Pole.
So if there's anyone out there who needs to lose 10 kilograms,
that's what I got
night.
From that clip. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
Amazing. So what does Nads remember? What's his first thought when it comes to the South Pole expedition then?
You know what? It's a weird one because the North Pole, I was so cold. So I was living in Bahrain at the time, which isn't far from here. So the same temperature. It was about 40 degrees in Bahrain when I left to go to Canada. And then in the North Pole, it was like minus 40. So I'd gone from plus 40 to minus 40. I'd had an 80-degree drop in temperature. That's like, you know, boiling water, going from boiling water to freezing water. That drop in temperature.
Yeah, that's huge.
And I had, and it, you know, the coldest temperature in the North Pole that I suffered was about minus 80. And minus 80, you know, your eyeballs, every time you blink, the fluid on your eye freezes. So every time you blink, you're breaking ice and its icicles are going into your eyelid. Because every time you blink, you get and the fluid inside your eyeball freezes. So it's just horrible.
What would happen if you took your goggles off for like 5 minutes?
If you kept your eyes open, every time you blinked, you'd have icicles in your eyes. It's just too cold. And also,
so would your eyeballs freeze?
Yeah. I mean, I was in minus 40 and I was trying to pray and every time I went to bend, the fluid in my elbows and knees had frozen. So I'd had to break the ice in my joints to bend over. So I said, right, that's the last time I do that in the open. So it was so cold. So the one thing that I remember about the South Pole was I had learnt a lot of lessons on temperature management, which isn't just about keeping warm. It's about keeping the right bits warm, you know, feet and hands and nose and ears. Because you don't want to sweat. If you sweat, the sweat freezes, and that's also bad. So the one thing that I always remember about the Antarctic was how hot it was. Minus 20?
That is not hot.
I know, but so there's a picture of me, and I'm actually in a long-sleeve T-shirt, and I've got my hands all gloved up, my feet are all wrapped up, but my actual body, because I'm working hard, I'm actually hot. I'm in this valley trying to get to base camp for Vincent, and I'm actually wearing almost like, you know, what I would wear in Dubai on my chest and arms. And that was mainly for UV protection. And so that's what I always think about when I think about the Antarctic, how hot it was.
If you just tune in, we're in conversation with Arab adventurer Nads Al-Busaidi. He's talking about his expedition at the South Pole. He's done the North Pole as well. It wasn't hot all the time, though, when he went to the South Pole. It got very rough and very cold towards the end.
On the summit day, it was minus 50. We had 100-kilometre winds. It was borderline, you know, the guides were saying we can't do it. It's, you know, it's borderline not safe to go up and do and summit. So the actual summit day was a hard, hard day and also very bad, bad conditions. But getting to base camp, minus 20, I was like, God, it's hot.
So, Michelle, Nads has done South Pole, North Pole. He's also rowed across the Atlantic. Which one do you think out of those three would be the toughest? If I said to you, you had to do the hardest one, which one would you pick?
Well, the first one, he said he was hallucinating in the blizzards.
Yeah.
The second one, he said he froze his eyeballs.
Yeah.
So this one, are you saving the best for last or something?
Yep, this one, this adventure was definitely the toughest.
I always thought that, I was in the army, British Army. I went and I did commando course and I did a whole bunch of stuff. And I thought the commando course was the hardest thing I ever did in my life. And then I went to the North Pole. I was like, oh my God, I'd rather do the commando course like five times than do this North Pole again. But then when I went and rode the Atlantic, I was like, I'd rather walk to the North Pole 9 times and do this rowing. This rowing is nuts. After one day, I was like, I need to get off this boat. I don't think I can. Oh my God. I'll tell you, there was one, and this was before we had set off. So before we set off from the Canary Islands, there was a whole bunch of people who'd done it before. They all come to say, you know, see the new people going off, you know. I think they come to commiserate, actually. But there was one group who'd come, and they were saying this story about how they'd rowed across the Atlantic. Oh, they were trying to row across the Atlantic, and unfortunately, their boat sank. So they'd sent out an SOS, and a yacht came along and picked them up. So they were saying, you know, oh, you know, they were you know, grateful for being saved, but then these guys wouldn't let them go down into the boat and dry or anything. They just picked them up and let them stand, and they were like, come on, we need to go down and dry off and eat and drink. And they were like, no.
What?
And they were insisting, please, we need, and then they brought out guns. And they were like, okay, right, we're not going to argue too much now. And they then, these people from the yacht, threw over a lifeboat, made all these guys, the rowers, get in this lifeboat. And then they left. And unfortunately, this lifeboat had a leak. So 24 hours after being rescued from the middle of the ocean, they'd just been dumped back in the ocean in a leaky lifeboat by people with guns who they had no idea what was going on. They didn't, you know, they obviously didn't give the full story. They just said, you know, no, we're not going to dry you off and feed you. You're going to get into this lifeboat that's got a hole in it. And 24 hours later, they're back in the same situation in the middle of the Atlantic.
Horrific.
No hope for a rescue. And 24 hours later, they got rescued by another boat.
That is an awful story.
That's it. Almost impossible. If you do not understand how big the Atlantic is until you've rowed across it, you can go across that ocean. You know, 43 days we rowed across the Atlantic, and we only came across one boat and one plane in 43 days. And every single other day, you could look around in every direction in 30 nautical miles and not see a thing.
It's mad, isn't it?
Oh,
rowing across the Atlantic. We had two guys in. I don't know if you remember this, Michelle. It's probably about a year ago now.
Yes, with
they were
the wife.
Do it.
Yes.
One Square Atlantic, they were called. And it was a guy from Dubai and a guy from my hometown, Newcastle, back in the UK. And they'd been chatting. They'd been friends before he moved to Dubai. And they'd been chatting about this challenge they could do. And they both quite liked rowing. The guy in the UK did it professionally. The guy who lived in Dubai didn't really do it professionally. And I remember seeing him before he went. So what kind of training have you done? He said, oh, I spent a lot of time on the rowing machine in the gym.
No.
I'm like, okay.
What about the seasickness and the rocking?
Oh, when he came back, his stories. He said he was delirious the whole time. On, I think it was the third day, they'd washed their clothes and put them on the side to dry. And they'd blown off. So they had to do most of it with no clothes.
No.
And he said there was one day when he did that with his gloves, and his gloves went, and he was so upset. Like, lost the plot on this boat.
It's like Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
When Tom Hanks lost, who is it?
Wilson!
Come back, Wilson! Yeah.
So yeah. The other guy had to give him one of his gloves, and they only had one glove each for the rest of the trip. But I said to him when he came back, I said, you don't seem to have, don't take this the wrong way, but you don't seem to have lost much weight. And he said that's because his mum, before he set off, they didn't know this, their boat was meant to weigh a certain amount. His mum had sneaked on more dry food than they had put on the boat. So she'd gone on and put it under seats, behind things, on shelves, like stacked it full of food.
And they found it along
the way. They found
it all. They're like, thanks, Mom.
Yes, he said, I was never hungry. I ate loads and loads and loads of food on the trip.
Just didn't wear any clothes and had one glove on.
Mm, but he said he would never do it again. Never, never, never. Not for all the money in the world.
I think you have to love the sea to be able to do something like that. You know, as Nads mentioned, 43 days they went and they saw one boat and one plane.
Do you know the other thing? The guys who came in told us that they were doing it for charity. They said that there was a part of it, I think it was about the middle of the trip, where it was stormy and literally they had to tie themselves in and the boat just rolled for 2 days.
No.
Yeah.
Rolled around and around.
Yeah. Just got tossed around between the waves. Oh, it's so scary. And his wife was at home watching the GPS and she could see that it was just being thrown around. It would just be terrifying. Welcome back to The Ticket. In about half an hour's time, we are setting you up for Father's Day. Yep, it's on Sunday. Don't forget. Very important. We've got everything you need to know when it comes to gifts. Michelle has been working hard to find the most creative gifts to blow your dad's socks off.
Oh, you set it up quite high standards there.
Yeah, no pressure. Right, we're talking to Nads Al-Busaidi, who is an Arab adventurer. And we're talking about his adventures. One of them is rowing across the Atlantic, which just sounds like the toughest thing in the world. If you just tune in, you can hear the rest of his story on our podcast, of course. But the next bit of this gets really, really rough. I feel like I do have to warn you.
As soon as we started rowing, I started getting seasick. And we'd been offered two choices before we got on the boat. Do you want English seasickness pills or French seasickness pills? What's the difference? I don't know what the difference is. What's the big difference between English and French? I'll take the English. But the English seasickness pills are taken orally, and the French are taken...
Yep, we can work out how the French ones are taken. So, Michelle, which pills would you be taking, the English ones or the French ones?
Oh, my goodness. I suppose it depends how sick you are, because they often say the French ones will make you better very quickly, and the English ones you just have to wait. But honestly, perhaps the English, but...
Uh-oh. Looks like you'd be making the same mistake as Nads then.
So I'm getting seasick. First shift, I get seasick. And so I think, well, okay, I'll take the English seasickness pills. Of course, it doesn't work because you just throw it up. So I say, oh, God, I wish I'd gone French for once. Anyway, I was so seasick. For the five days, for the first 5 days, I threw up every single off shift. So you row for 2 hours and then you're off in the cabin for 2 hours. Every time I got in the cabin, I threw up 2-3 times. So over 5 days, that's over 100 times I threw up. I couldn't keep any water down. I couldn't keep any food down. So eventually, I was so weak and passing out from exhaustion, I ate some chili con carne. I said, I am not throwing this up. There's no way I'm throwing this up. I am going to keep this down. So I ate it. As soon as I got in the cabin, I started to throw up. I put my hand over my mouth and I blocked my nose and I threw up and it came out my eyes.
Oh! I did not see that coming. I thought this was going to be a nice ending of, and it stayed in. That's a low light right there.
Yeah. So that was probably my worst day, because I was so desperate to get some food and nutrition. And even then, and so we had a limited number of rations and limited number of menus. And every time somebody had chili con carne from then on, I couldn't smell it because it would set me off. I was like, that's it.
Would you like to row across the Atlantic? I have got two passes here.
Oh, is it our new deal of the week? Huh. No, thanks.
I'm never going to do that.
I just wonder what kind of person puts themselves through that. You must have so much resilience and you must be so passionate about achieving these goals.
To then come back and plan another one, it's incredible.